Hey, folks, the Sunset Lake 420 sale is still going on right now. It started on the 13th and it ends on the 24th at midnight at 11:59 p.m. 40% off smokables like hemp flower, pre-rolls, and keef, and 30% off everything else. No promo code is needed. The products are already discounted on the website. This is also for a good cause, because Majority Report and Sunset Lake have paired up with the Innocence Project. We've teamed up with everyone's on everyone's favorite stoner holiday, and we've turned it into a fundraising opportunity for the Innocence Project, a great organization working to undo the damage of the war on drugs. Here's how it works. Visit sunsetlakecbd.com. Starting Wednesday, April 13th, Sunset Lake CBD will be offering 40% off smokables like hemp flower, pre-rolls, and keef, as I mentioned, and every other product, 30% off. The tincture I have mentioned is my favorite Sunset Lake product. I use it all the time. I mean, Matt uses the, what would you say, the keef?
I use the keef and the smalls, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I
want. Sam and Emma are big tincture heads.
Yes, we are. Although I would rather not be associated with him any longer. So maybe I'm going to go with the smalls and the keef. Sunset Lake will donate 4.2% of sales, 4.20, in fact, of its sales to the Innocence Project, a nonprofit organization that works to free the innocent, prevent wrongful convictions, and create fair, compassionate, and equitable systems of justice for everyone. Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned business that donated more than $26,000 last year to anti-drug war organizations, animal shelters, union strike funds, nature conservation, food shelves, and refugee resettlement organizations. Again, visit sunsetlakecbd.com to take advantage of these discounts and help Majority Report raise money for a great organization. The sale ends on the 24th, April 24th. Don't miss it. And with that, we're on to this program.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, April 18th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the 5-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Gina Dent, Associate Professor of Feminist Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, to discuss her recent book, Abolition, Feminism, Now, co-written with Angela Davis, Erica Miners, and Beth Ritchie. Meanwhile, Russian forces launched one of its broadest attacks since the invasion. It started earlier this morning with missiles launched into mostly the eastern part of the country, but also in the western city of Lviv, where 7 have died. That city was largely untouched thus far in the war. Israeli police once again attacked the Al-Aqsa Mosque on Sunday during Ramadan and Passover, bringing the total injury to over 170 when combined with Friday's assault. The U.S. arrested over 200,000 migrants attempting to cross the border from Mexico last month, the highest monthly total in 2 decades. Nothing will fundamentally change, said Biden. Remember that? And in South Carolina, 2 shootings rocked the state over the weekend. 14 were injured at a mall in Columbia, South Carolina, when 2 shooters opened fire, reportedly. And then 9 were injured at a separate shooting at a restaurant and bar a day later. Legal cannabis will officially start sales in New Jersey the day after 420 this week, this Thursday. It's been a long road. And the FDA has authorized the first coronavirus breath test, which can be administered at pop-up sites and doctor's offices with results in a few minutes. But thus far, it'll fail to detect around 1 in every 10 positive cases. So we're still figuring these things out. And lastly, Alex Jones's InfoWars has filed for bankruptcy in the wake of the multiple defamation lawsuits that Jones is facing. So there is some good news today. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. It is April 18th, which means it is my birthday. Yes.
Happy birthday.
Hey. We'll celebrate a little bit more in the fun half, have some good times. But, you know, should we just talk about basketball the entire podcast, man? I mean, is that a new Timberwolves hat that you have on?
No, it's an old one that I, rolled my cat hairs off, and it's time to bust out the Timberwolves stuff. I'm a fan now. I'm a fan again.
It's like if the Knicks ever have like this amount of young talent, I will be back on the train again.
If the Knicks ever had a prospect like Anthony Edwards, I'm worried about. I'd be worried about New York City.
Oh my God!
Be imposed martial law or something.
They would have to. You saw what happened when they won one playoff game against the Hawks. I thought like the entire city was going to sink into the ground.
I'd get a blue and orange suit if Anthony Edwards was on the Knicks.
And just wear it to the office.
Yeah, I would wear it every day probably.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. Like I do care about the Knicks. I love them, but it's difficult to be engaged on a yearly basis with the way that they conduct their business. So go Rangers. That's all I have to say right now. That's where all of my energy is directed, but I am into the NBA playoffs. Great weekend this weekend of games.
Transcendent.
So let's get into it's a bit of a slow news day today, I would say, but I want to keep shining a light on this, broader unionization push around the country. Although when we spoke to Alex Press last week about it, she wasn't trying to be a Debbie Downer, but she was just not trying to downplay the enormous obstacles that unionization efforts still face throughout the country. And those obstacles are led by very well-funded and well-financed capitalists who make it their mission to stamp out union efforts in the country, and they spend millions and millions of dollars on union busting lawyers and firms like Amazon did. Here is Amazon CEO Andy Jassy. People, I think, may not even know that Bezos is now in a different role. Jassy is now the CEO, probably because Amazon's board figure that Bezos has become like kind of a Lex Luthor figure for everybody who is trying to call attention to income inequality in this country. So this guy is supposed to be the new fresh face for Amazon. And yet it's the same old rhetoric, anti-union. Well, we're not anti-union. Everyone should have the freedom to do so. But here are the reasons why we are actually against unions and why we spent millions in order to prevent one union or two unions from sprouting up in our facilities, because we understand it's an existential threat to not the business, but to the $212 million payments in a year that Amazon CEO Andy Jassy received.
How do you see the union movement that's taking place, frankly, around the country, but clearly aimed in certain places? And I'm thinking about New York, where I'm from, at Amazon.
Well, I mean, I'd say a few things. You know, first of all, of course, it's employees' choice whether or not they want to join a union. We happen to think they're better off not doing so for a couple reasons, at least. You know, first, a place like Amazon empowers employees. If they see something they can do better for customers or for themselves, then go meet in a room, decide how to change it, and change it. That type of empowerment doesn't happen when you have unions. It's much more bureaucratic.
That is not the experience Smalls had at the Staten Island when they're talking about, hey, you're not protecting us from this pandemic that's going to kill close to a million people.
It's much slower. Now, I also think people are better off having direct connections with their managers. You know, you think about work differently. You have relationships that are different. We get to hear from a lot of people as opposed to it all being filtered through one voice. If you want to keep the construct.
Yeah, we do get to hear from a lot of people, including people like Christian Smalls, who we fired in retaliation for speaking out about this.
Yeah, their own individual connections that isn't like sort of coordinated in any way, and sort of everybody is individually kept in the dark as to what other people are negotiating. So it is easier.
We prefer our workers to be atomized.
It's the solution we prefer for an efficient wage setting.
Yes. Right. I just love that concept. Like, yeah, as opposed to hearing one voice who would have a unified message behind how we want wages to increase and working conditions to improve. We'd rather it be completely dispersed so that our workers don't have the ability to coordinate with one another. And by the way, CNBC, maybe have a worker on. Maybe have one.
Yeah, for 5 minutes on a question like this.
Yeah, or just like, you know, as a counterbalance in terms of like not just allowing the CEO of Amazon to spout out how it's empowering to not be in a union.
Yeah, now that's the fairness doctrine I want to see implemented.
Oh, hell yeah.
They're different. We get to hear from a lot of people as opposed to it all being filtered through one voice. If you want to keep the construct that we've had for this long, you have to have, you know, competitive and compelling benefits, though, for employees. And it's why we championed the $15 minimum wage a few years ago.
Pause it. You did not champion the $15 minimum wage. The only reason that was implemented was because Bernie Sanders started and parlayed his popularity coming out of the 2016 presidential election to introduce the Stop Bezos Act, BEZOS, as an acronym in order to raise wages. And then with his public pressure, Disney did the same, but Amazon did the same. And they were forced into doing so because there was so much push against their unfair work practices.
And again, it's so fork-tongued whenever they do this $15 minimum wage thing, because the jobs that they're replacing, these warehouse jobs, pay a hell of a lot more, particularly when they're unionized, than $15. Mm-hmm. And it's Amazon, this mass spreading of these Amazon warehouses is undercutting those wages. So it's not, I'm glad you support $15 minimum wage. A giant monopoly of that size can do that in a way that frankly advantages them over smaller firms, for which like that's a bigger ask. But Amazon has so much money that of course they can do measly $15 minimum wage.
$18 now. It's why we have full insurance, why 401k, 20 weeks of paid leave, and our career choice program where in our fulfillment center.
Career choice. And there's so much here.
The way that he mentions those sort of very basic things, like the basic benefits of things like healthcare, this is why corporations don't want the government to provide stuff mm-hmm. like that. So they can use it as a, oh, look at us. Look at how great we're doing something that when all these capitalists like this donate to politicians, whether it's Democrat or Republican, they're doing it to politicians that aren't going to take those things off the table
yes.
for them.
And a reminder, too, that if you are a worker who is a gig employee by Amazon, you do not fall right. under the umbrella that he's speaking about that right there. They don't provide those same benefits. Keep going.
Paid leave. And our career choice program where in our fulfillment center, for our employees who want to get a college education, we'll pay for their full tuition. So those things really matter. The one thing
again, just on how
there's so much here, I know,
right?
Yeah.
It's all these different things that they like to get basically like tax deductible. I don't know how it works on the business side, but it's a way that advantages them.
Mm-hmm. Regardless of how it all evolves, is we just won't compromise on the customer experience. That for us, you know, is paramount. And
what did you think when you heard President Biden effectively say, and this is in regard to the unions around Amazon, here we come?
Well, everyone's entitled to their own opinion. And, you know, we have a lot of things that we, I think, have supported the administration on and agree with them on. You know, some of the way that we've tried to help with COVID and with immigration. And
pause it. Okay. Hmm. With immigration. What's that?
I don't understand what that's.
With COVID, they issued a press release in early January 2021 trying to say, we will help with the vaccine rollout, Biden administration. Not sure anything came of that because that was largely outsourced to to drugstores, which has its own issues, by the way. Although there were some state, you know, pop-up clinics like here in New York, et cetera. But in terms of like the booster effort, that's all drugstores. But I don't even think anything came of that. They just like, they thought that that would make them look good. Yeah. So that's what they, and because I'm sorry, really quickly, Matt, like Amazon has because we are such a like backwards country in terms of how we have developed our infrastructure for these kinds of things. Amazon understands that because they're such a massive monopoly and they have such wide tentacles throughout the country reach areas that the government can't, that they have the leverage to exert that kind of power on the Biden administration if they so chose to.
Yeah. And so that PR failed, but also, bro, the union that just formed did so specifically on concerns of COVID safety and how your company wasn't addressing it. So I'm glad your public initiatives, that's all good and well. But this is specifically to the unionizing. That's why they're doing it.
Yeah, I don't think we really need to hear that much more. It just, that's
what do you think of his?
They're terrified.
Sort of look, he's got the sort of like frazzled hair, a suit with like a.
I know, it looks like there's paint stains on it.
It's like weird little like salt and pepper sort of like.
It's that kind of thing when you're so rich that I'm sure that jacket is $20,000 or something like that.
The fun rich guy.
Yeah. I want polka dot suit next. All right. We have to take a quick break. But when we come back, we will be joined by Gina Dent. First, we have, a bunch of sponsors. I got it, Bradley. I got it.
It's your birthday. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah. Hell yeah. So I believe this is a new sponsor for us today. Free email services like Gmail and Yahoo aren't really free. You pay with your privacy. Internet giants exploit your data by selling it to the highest bidder. But with SmartMail, you can feel safe again. SmartMail keeps your email private. Every email can be encrypted, even if the recipient doesn't use encryption. When you delete an email in SmartMail, it is gone forever, as opposed to these other services like they mentioned. Switching to SmartMail is seamless. Transfer all your current email data instead of starting from scratch. SmartMail uses their own servers and is backed by the most stringent privacy laws in the world. With SmartMail, you get unlimited anonymous aliases. So when you're giving your email to a company but want to protect your identity, SmartMail can generate a shareable alias email that can be deleted at any time. Now, look, the more and more these major corporations try to integrate your email addresses and all of your information into a service that's cleaner for you, the more that information is going to be at risk to people. And SmartMail protects you from those kinds of things. Those bigger service providers, they're just, it makes you more vulnerable to that information getting leaked out. So start securing your email privacy with SmartMail. Sign up today and you'll get 50% off your first year. Go to smartmail.com/majority. That's startmail. startmail.com/majority. That's startmail with a T, not what I just said. startmail.com/majority for 50% off your first year. startmail.com/majority. Now, for this sponsor, one of my best friends is a psychologist. And I was saying, look, I really need to get more into meditating because I'm on my phone too much. The synapses in my brain, they're getting fried. Headspace has been able to help me with that. Headspace is a scientifically proven app to help you manage your feelings and your mental health. In fact, a recent study proved in just 2 weeks, Headspace can reduce your stress by 14%. Once you download the Headspace app and try their mindfulness routines, it just takes a few minutes a day to change your relationship with stress and anxiety to start feeling better. Whether you want to relieve stress and anxiety, sleep better, or improve your focus, Headspace is your everyday dose of mindfulness for real life. So, I mean, I have the app downloaded. I need to be better about it. But when I was using it more consistently, I really felt that it helped my stress levels get reduced a little bit. I was more grounded, less thinking about what the next thing I had to do would be, stressing about how I have to like get this done. I have to fix this thing in my apartment. I've got to like save up for this, etc. It allows you to be in the present moment, which is something that I struggle with. So these kinds of apps, it just makes it easy. It's on your phone. And Headspace in particular, I mean, it's the best one. However you're feeling, try Headspace at headspace.com/majority and get 1 month free off their entire mindfulness library. This is the best Headspace offer. So go to headspace.com/majority today. headspace.com/majority. And lastly, we've heard about Grove here on this program. Now, Sam basically has talked about how Grove was huge for him in the pandemic in terms of getting all of his products. I've been using Grove as well. So at Grove Collaborative, they believe it's time to ditch single-use plastics for good. In fact, by 2025, Grove will be 100% plastic-free. Did you know that actually only 9% of plastic gets recycled, no matter how much we put into our recycling bin? That's like, it pisses me off because I make an effort to recycle, specifically at home. But Grove can help you with that. From laundry care to hand soaps and more, Grove carries hundreds of products aimed at replacing single-use plastics across every room of your home and your head-to-toe personal care routine. Grove Collaborative's concentrated cleaners and refillable glass bottles are friendlier to the planet and twice as effective as the leading natural brands. Over 2 million households already rely on Grove Collaborative for safe formulas and refillable packaging that never compromise on performance. Go to grove.com/majority today to get a free set worth up to $50 with your first order. Plus, shipping is fast and free. Get started right now at grove.com/majority, grove.com/majority. All right, folks, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll be joined by Gina Dent. We are back, and we are joined now by Gina Dent, Associate Professor of Feminist Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, to discuss her recent book, Abolition, Feminism Now, co-written by feminist scholars Angela Davis, Erica Miners, and Beth Ritchie. Thank you so much for being here, Gina.
Thank you for having me on and for highlighting the book.
I'm excited to talk about it with you. I guess let's start more broadly, and then we can talk more specifics. You know, when I think people are familiar with the term feminism, right? Even though we've talked about the perils and pitfalls of white feminism and capitalist feminism on the show many times, so there's a broadness to that. But an abolition, though, is becoming a more understood and accepted concept in our discourse. So yes. How do you feel? In your view, how are feminist and abolitionist strategies inextricably linked?
Yes, well, you know, it's so important now, and I'm glad you raised the point that abolition is part of our at least national and also international conversations now. And feminism, of course, has been with us for some time and is recognized and is still perceived as a threat. But the combination of abolition and feminism is what we're really focused on. And we're really focusing on the reasons why it's important to draw out the history of abolition work as feminist work, and also to highlight the idea that certain feminisms are not really the ones that we would want to align ourselves with because they are not abolitionist. So the book goes back and forth between addressing the history of abolition work against the prison industrial complex, and addressing feminisms that have not done the work of really looking at structural violence.
So let's talk a little bit about the feminist, the brands of feminism that have failed in this area. I think mm-hmm. it's easy to identify it as, you know, in the lean-in feminism, white feminism, right? Feminism that's not intersectional. But how would you describe it in your terms, I guess?
Sure. And they're the terms that we actually take from Elizabeth Bernstein, the author who first used this term, carceral feminism. And it sounds like a pretty difficult charge to call someone a carceral feminist. Of course, no one identifies as a carceral feminist. It's a label given to those who have not fully thought through the implications of their feminism on those who are at the bottom of our social ladder, those who are affected the most by gender violence. And if we don't look intersectionally, if we're not looking at capitalism, if we're not looking at the prison industrial complex, then we're missing so many who really need our feminisms. And so the label carceral feminism is designed to point out the degrees to which feminist work can, in fact, bolster the prison industrial complex and leave us with more and more people inside and leave us less and less safe.
Where do you trace carceral feminism back to, I guess, in U.S., within the context of United States mass incarceration and imprisonment?
Well, carceral feminism has been with us all along, but the height of it perhaps might be the 70s movement, the 80s, time when people were trying to get attention to rape and to gender violence, and where we started to measure the success of our movement in the number of years, for example, that someone might serve for a particular kind of harm or crime. And so the development of abolition feminism has always gone alongside this. And this is something we draw out in the book. There's always been a minoritized history of abolition feminist work, but carceral feminist work tends to get the label of feminism. It tends to be the one that people recognize as feminism.
Right. And that's because it's mainstreamed. But it also, you know, when you mentioned the 70s and 80s, Angela Davis, one of your co-writers, has always been at the forefront of prison abolition, has been imprisoned herself. How much did her personal experience help all of you in terms of crafting this work?
Yes. I mean, of the four of us, she's the only one who served time. I should say that this work by the four of us really extends back almost 30 years to work that we've been doing together. And it's not just Angela's experience inside. It's actually all of the people that we collaborate with and have worked with over decades who are really leading this movement. It's really our role to lift those acts up, to lift those people up, to lift those ideas up. But this work has been done by those who have suffered the most. And our book tries to highlight many organizations and also individuals who have been engaged in this work because they were incarcerated, because they have family members who were incarcerated, because they live in communities that are affected so deeply by incarceration.
So can you talk a bit about the silencing of Black feminist liberationists and non-mainstream feminists who are trying to present these topics as intersectional? Like, what has been your experience when trying to talk about these topics broadly and connecting them as well, as opposed to siloing them?
Yes, I think your word siloing is really how I've experienced it. It's not always a full out silencing. In fact, some forms of inclusion in the mainstream feminist movement have been the most troubling. When we think about the origins of, for example, the Violence Against Women Act, when we think about the role of our first Black woman senator, Carol Moseley Braun, in the crime bill of which VAWA is a part, we realize that the work of carceral feminism has also been the work of Black feminists sometimes, because we are often from the communities that are most affected. So yes, Black feminism has been sometimes marginalized, and even when it's lifted up, it can be a selective lifting up. It can be a selective reading of the literature and of the history. And so it's really important for us to ensure that we don't have to do the work of historical retrieval in, say, 30 or 50 years, or leave that work to others who will survive us. But we really want now to focus on how much abolition feminist work has been key to pursuing the real forms of freedom that we are wanting to see.
You mentioned the crime bill, and it's just, I mean, the ultimate example of the bastardization of, I think, feminist language, the using the concept of protection in order to uphold systems of violence and mass incarceration. And I think that's what's so key to your work in this book is to reframe it so people understand the state as a perpetrator of violence as well, which is for our lawmakers, people like our current president who crafted the crime bill, that is a complete maybe it's charitable to say that he doesn't, that he wouldn't understand that, or our lawmakers wouldn't understand that more. It's a willing ignorance, I guess.
Yes, I think it's an ignorance. It's also part of ceding to the political mainstream in various ways. Tough on crime has been, for the last several decades, the way for people to get elected. It's only recently that actually moving against that has been something that people would do. But I also think it's about not being able to follow the strategy that we label in the book as a both-and strategy, a strategy that comes primarily from Black feminism, but also from other women of color feminisms, and also from feminisms that are attentive to class. And that both-and means we simultaneously look at state violence and interpersonal violence. And any program, any policy, any law that doesn't address these simultaneously, or that bolsters the prison industrial complex under the guise of trying to give us protection, is for us a problem. And so, you know, we need to be out there explaining how we can do two things at once. And this is really a very difficult thing to say in the media. It's a very difficult thing to explain very quickly. It's not as easy to make a 10-point program to do this. And I think it's really important that we point out all of the different ways in which people have actually, from the very beginning of the modern feminist movement that we've been discussing, been doing the work of trying to say that our bolstering the prison industrial complex is not the way we want to treat the harms that happen to us, and that the state has been a perpetrator from everything from searches in prison to unfair policing to the family policing system, as our scholar Dorothy Roberts calls child protective services. And so there are many, many ways in which women in particular who are placed in our society in such a way that they suffer from multiple kinds of violations need to be thought of and centered in order for us to get to the point where we can do both things at once.
How there's a retribution element to or at least the veneer of retribution in these kinds of tough on crime laws, like specifically as it relates to violence against gendered violence against women. But in fact, it's only an exacerbating force. And sometimes women are disproportionately affected by it as well. Can you talk about that impulse and how embedded it is right now in society, even though like it's obviously, I think there's many people understand that it is harmful on the whole, but the impulse still remains. What do you identify as driving that?
Well, there's so many things. I mean, the book references capitalism, and by this we're then not talking about the United States, the power and the force of the capitalist enterprise, which has defined safety in a variety of ways and has made us impoverish our social networks and our social supports is part of what puts us in this position. There are also so many ways that we, especially in the United States, but of course many parts of the world, think only about our immediate family, our immediate context, what we know or have experienced. And for those who have not experienced incarceration, either themselves or in their families or in their communities, the perception is always that the people who are inside are the bad people, are the people who have done these incredible harms. But those of us who have been working on this issue for a very long time really understand the force of criminalization, the force of race and gender, and in the criminalization of so many of us. And so we need to focus on that. We need to focus on why we perceive some people as more dangerous than others. We see this, of course, when we're looking at police violence. We see this, of course, when we're looking at various ways in which communities are targeted. We look at so many different kinds of factors that affect criminalization. But that retribution is the thing that feels the easiest. It feels easy to say, someone harmed me, let me get back at them. However, the people who are talking about this are often not the people who have been so harmed. And it's one of the ways in which representation of these issues is really a problem. And it's something we also try to address in the book.
And how does, you mentioned the focus on interpersonal harm as opposed mm-hmm. to state harm. Mm-hmm. How does the individualizing of violence in terms of the way that the state treats it, how does that, I guess, that action exacerbate violence as opposed to addressing it?
Well, certainly. I mean, the individualization of violence and the individualization of everything that we're experiencing. We're living in the era of COVID in which we become so individually responsible for things, and there's so little community support and state support for what we're experiencing. And I'm not saying there aren't programs, but those programs tend to exacerbate the very same disparities that exist in society that we know are exacerbated when we're focusing on crime. And so one of the strategies that we speak about is the idea of disarticulating crime and punishment. In order for us to really understand the prison system and all of the damage it's done, we actually have to stop thinking about incarceration as a consequence of crime. Because in fact, so many people are imprisoned for reasons that are beyond their control. They could be innocent of the things they're charged with. They could be put in situations that make it impossible for them to thrive. And those situations are the ones that provide the main routes toward incarceration. And so for us, we need to separate out, disarticulate the discussion of crime from the discussion of punishment. Punishment in the form of incarceration has never done anything to rehabilitate. I'm being a little strong there, and I would say that some people who have served time have said even to us that the time that they served had an effect on their lives. But I do want to say if they were given certain resources in the free world that they were given inside, then they would also have experienced this transformation. In other words, what would it be like to have education before you're incarcerated? What would it be like to have healthcare before you're incarcerated? What would it be like to have drug treatment programs? We have internalized all of these functions to the system of incarceration, and those services are delivered inside in a way that is deeply disturbing and brutal to those who are experiencing them. Even though they sometimes provide small benefits, we'd like to see those benefits provided in the free world so that people do not have to suffer inside.
So, I mean, and I think, okay, may I ask in terms of how, you know, you're being broad, I guess, because abolition requires that in terms yes. of dismantling this, right? Is that a deliberate rhetorical strategy on your part?
Absolutely. I mean, the way that this plays out day to day is very local and very micro. But the way that we think about it for the book and for the work we do is always at the macro level. It's always broad. We have to think about the way in which incarceration is not only a practice inside the United States, and that wasn't necessarily originated in the United States, depending on which history you follow, but has been elaborated in the United States and spread across the world. We have to look at the way in which the various failures that we have in society, like healthcare, like schooling, are feeding the prison industrial complex. And so without paying attention to these things, we actually can't get to the problem of incarceration, and we certainly can't get toward abolition. And finally, I would say, as a feminist who's been concerned about gender violence for a very long time, that as much as I've been concerned about incarceration, We can't get to a place where we don't have harms if we are not attending to the true causes of those harms and trying to address them outside of a carceral environment.
And the causes of those harms, again, as we laid out earlier, exacerbated by a punitive system. But what's interesting, too, is you mentioned the crime bill, mm-hmm. how it almost seems deliberate, but how starkly feminism and punishment became interlinked during that time period, at least in the mainstream discourse, right? And in the way it was reflected in our political legislation and laws and in mass incarceration. Like, I mean, how do you reckon with that time period, I guess, when all of that rhetoric and then the legislation that followed was very much in vogue?
Absolutely. And we haven't really outlived it. I mean, of course, we've seen a transformation. People focus on 2020 as a massive transformation in the representation of many of these issues. Many of these questions that we've been speaking about for years, we could not speak about in mainstream media. We couldn't even use the term structural racism. We couldn't talk about gender violence, except in the context of wanting to incarcerate those that have been the perpetrators of gender violence and harm. We couldn't talk about the state in these ways. And so these are things that are transforming. But of course, in the era of the 1990s, when we're talking about the development of the crime bill in VAWA, we're also talking about the attack on welfare state, the other things that went along with the dismantling of the social supports that so many people need. So it's not coincidental that more and more people are going into prison at the very same time that a lot of these issues are being discussed and that more harms are being created. We know, for example, that those who are prison guards, for example, tend to be around situations that trigger violence in them, that create more violence in communities, that the domestic violence statistics in communities that are that have jails or prisons at their center go up. And so we understand that the prison and the jail itself actually is a generator of gender harm, and we need to pay attention to these things. But it's very difficult to pay attention to them in an environment where we're all scrambling to survive. And when we are now in an era where we talk regularly about multi-billionaires and their capacity to control more than our own nation states.
We were just talking about that before you came on in terms of Amazon's infrastructure rivaling yes. that of, this, if not surpassing,
yes.
that of our state. And you touched on that, dissolving of social programs, the rolling back of them that was paired with our mass incarceration. And I'm just wondering if you could expand on the concept of care being manipulated into now being incarceration. You yeah. talked about it a little bit in terms of how when the state gets involved in breaking up families, for example, which is often yeah. heavily racialized and has to do with poverty as well. The entire concept of state care is now just state punishment and incarceration, and that seemed to have happened quite rapidly, all under the guise of feminism as well. Not all under it, but in terms of the, I just wanted to correct myself a bit, you know, that not all under it, but that was a small part.
Alongside it, of
yes,
course.
Yes, alongside it.
Yes. I mean, you mentioned the term protection earlier, and it's, of course, a part of this discourse. The invitation that we have to participate in systems that are criminalizing and that are creating further harms comes often because of this word protection or the word care. Protection is the word that's often used when we're talking about gender violence and we're talking about women and increasingly even trans folks and non-binary folks who are identified as those that need protection from the law and from the state. But what we're finding is that given that the prison system itself is a gendering institution, and given that inside the violences increase and in fact are perpetuated, then we need to try and understand why it is that the easy solutions that are proffered to us are the ones we should not accept. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to go against the impulses to use the system. I was recently told about a case in the Bay Area, which we're going to try and begin to advertise, and a young girl was killed after her family members were trying to make it safe for her to live by removing her from the home of her mother, but also without criminalizing the mother and without having the child in Child Protective Services. And yet what ended up happening was that the child was left in the situation where she was suffering, partly because we have a kind of anxious way of both not wanting to intrude into other people's lives and at the same time provide protection under the guise of a state authority. And so we really need to start working on these other ways that are being developed all over the world of taking care of each other, of being with each other through these crises, and of not promoting additional incarceration or the use of child protective services to treat these very serious problems. One thing I don't want to forget to say here is that we are all people who've been involved in some way or another with work against gender violence and against harm against children. We never want to see these harms increased. But we understand, after studying this for many, many years and experiencing it ourselves, that these systems are not well set up to support us, to protect us, or, as you pointed out, to care for us.
You mentioned the Child Protective Services part of this, and I feel that we don't even talk about that enough because it's touchy, right? But
yes,
there is a paternalism and a there is a violent element, of course, to when the state gets involved often. And yes, sometimes there are cases that are extreme and children are affected, but oftentimes it's the state punishing people for their own poverty, which is a through line we see in America. But it's a particularly violent punishment. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your work in that area and your writing there.
Yes, and I will point again, I think I mentioned Dorothy Roberts, and she's been working on this issue in a number of ways, and she has a book that's just coming out. And her description of the system, actually, as a family policing system, was really key to our thinking about this issue. Unfortunately, there are many, many children who do need to be cared for better. But they're in environments and families where we also need more care. So how do we create environments in which people can thrive? How do we create an environment which heals the family, which heals the community, which gives the community enough resources, which gives the family enough resources, so that the kinds of harms that we have identified are actually ones that are not going to be prominent in our environments? We're not so idealistic as to imagine that this will magically happen overnight. And one of the problems is trying to wean ourselves off of these systems when they're the only systems that we have. And part of this is a problem of state power and the law and the ways in which we all find ourselves constantly grappling with the legal limitations and the solutions that are proffered by the law, which is why they're also a focus in our book.
So I guess we can turn a little bit more towards how we move forward from here as well. There are restorative justice pockets in this country. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, the concept of reform. We're seeing some of these in more progressive district attorneys getting elected. Mm-hmm. But you argue that reform is, you're arguing for abolition of these systems as opposed mm-hmm. to reform. What's some of the hope that you see in that move towards reform in some areas of this country? And what are some of the pitfalls you see of that being some of the focus of many on the left?
Yes, there's an organization called Critical Resistance that all of us have had some kind of affiliation to over the years. And there's a chart in our book that Critical Resistance actually generated about the difference between reformist reforms and non-reformist reforms. That's a distinction that actually came to us from Scandinavia. It's a longer story about the use of those terms. But to put it simply, we're looking at the reforms that helped us to decarcerate and move toward abolition as being the non-reformist reforms. So we're not saying we're against changes. We're not saying we're against support for those who need it now. What we are saying is that we need to look at these reforms and make sure they are truly liberatory. So when we think, for example, back to what we've been speaking about, like VAWA, we need to understand that though that was perceived as a reform, and in fact, VAWA has been revised over the years since in many ways to try to include, for example, Indigenous folks, to include trans folks, to include others who've been excluded. However, even with those inclusions, the proffering of this system as a solution is nonetheless a problem. And so we are really trying to focus also on all of the ways in which we can move toward, as you pointed out, restorative justice. There are several terms that are not retributive justice, not the punishment justice that we're so familiar with. There are transformative justice projects. There are restorative justice projects. The problem is that we can never simply understand what this project will do by the label. So there are many things that go by the term restorative justice that might be more in line with what we think of as a reformist reform. And there are also many things that go under that name, restorative justice, that are truly doing the work of moving us toward a society which does not incarcerate. We know as abolitionists that we won't get to a society that doesn't incarcerate just by opening up the gates and the walls. What we're trying to do is move toward a society where people know how to treat each other, where we take collective responsibility, where we look at the incredible wealth disparities and address them, where we address the other forms of disparity that we've been talking about. But we do this in a loving context. We do this in an abolition feminist context where we are all caring for each other. We are not just looking out for our own families or for ourselves.
Before I let you go, I have just one final question, because you mentioned the inclusion of Indigenous people in this, of trans people mm-hmm. in this vision. And I mean, I think that's really important to emphasize, given how those, particularly in feminism, there's a whole group of feminists that want trans women excluded from that idea. And Indigenous people in this country have been excluded from larger, almost every conversation about how we're going to make our systems more equitable or abolish them altogether. So if you don't mind just reiterating and expanding upon that emphasis that you made there, because I do mm-hmm. think it's key.
Absolutely. And it's part of the kinds of incorporation into state systems that we find so dangerous. But it comes from a motivation which is very important, and we need to recognize that gender is also a system which is making many people suffer. And of course, we know this from everything from Florida to, you know, other parts of the country where we're actually seeing legislation that is designed to bring more and more pain to those who are trying to live in a world in which we don't solidify the gender binary. But we also know, and this is something that's so important for me as a Black woman to raise, that the rate of incarceration of Indigenous folks in this country is higher than the rate for Black people. And so much of the conversation that we have is exclusively about jails and state facilities. But when we talk about jails in Indian country or federal prisons, we're bringing in an entirely other group of people that we really need to attend to. And so we want to attend again to the harms that are happening to all of these people, but not by incorporating more and more people into the framework of VAWA or the punishment system.
Well, I can't thank you enough for your time. Gina Dent, Associate Professor of Feminist Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, co-author of Abolition, Feminism Now, Angela Davis, Erica Miners, Beth Ritchie, the other authors of this great work. Thank you so much for your time today, Gina.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. All right, folks. With that, we are going to say goodbye to the first hour of this program, and we're going to head into the fun half, where we'll be taking your calls, doing some clips, making fun of Tucker Carlson's homoerotic documentary series, potentially.
Tucker had a busy week.
Oh, yeah.
He has a few docs coming out for Tucker Carlson Originals.
So oh, they were. Yeah, that's what it is, right?
His, like, his like little studio, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I wonder how Ben Shapiro and the Daily Wire feel about him encroaching on their cinematic universe.
With the original content.
I know, right? Enough. Daily Wire wants a monopoly, but there's too many competitors here. We'll be taking your call, 646-257-3920. But first, Matt, what's happening this week in Left Reckoning?
Yeah, on Left Reckoning for patrons, we had Lillian Cherchurkia of the What's Left of Philosophy podcast on to talk about an interesting article she wrote, which is actually a review of a book on Marx and his relationship with liberal rights. And Lillian argues that liberal rights are not something that we should thank capitalism for, and that they were won often in spite of capitalist power. And it's also a reason that the left should take things like free speech and that stuff seriously and not just a sort of outgrow a bourgeois right, but something that actually delivers for workers. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning. There's a teaser on the podcast feed if you want about 5-6 minutes of it.
And can I do a brief plug?
What?
Yes. It's just because I was on Gregory from Oklahoma's show a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And the episode just came out. So if you guys want to check out the Green Corn Rebellion show, I was on that. We talked for a really long time just about like our upbringings and some fun stuff. And also, obviously, our shared love of nu metal. So check it out.
Green Corn Rebellion. Check it out. Gregory from Oklahoma. I see you there, Bradley. Look at that. What hat did you break out for that one?
Oh, it's just like I got it for Christmas. It's just like a fun little hat that's like has a little red string around it. It's kind of like my going out hat.
Okay,
my,
gotcha.
My party hat.
Yeah, I'm always, you know, I'm envious. I should just wear a hat on the show one day because I do. I wear them a good amount, like when my hair's messy and I don't do anything with it. But you know, I want people to see that side of me. All right, we're gonna head into the fun half. 646-257-3920. Bye bye.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports.
We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start life.
Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. 1/2. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. You can call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late. And the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.